Diversity.
You have caused confusion.
Oh, trash is spoiled.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another Office Hours. I am joined by Mark, making his return. How are you doing, Mark?
Very well, thank you.
So, well, this was going to be one of those goblin raid streams, Mark, because I don't have a huge amount of time, although I do have some interesting stuff lined up for us to discuss. But how the devil have you been, sir?
Yeah, not too bad. Just been fighting off the bug, flu, COVID, whatever it is that's going around at the moment. So recovered from that now, and it's just a delight to be able to breathe normally, you know.
But, people are saying the Lotus Eaters are still on. Listen, right? 2 p.m. I start. Their show is at 12. Listen up, Carl. If you can't run a tight ship, sir, you know, his schedule is 12. I set the show at two, so you know, if they want to go into competition, let's do it. Come on, I'm Vince. No, anyway,
we have the non-aggression pact back in the day. No one will stream snipe anyone else.
Do you remember the cartel?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, it used to be 12. So you know, anyway, it doesn't matter. I don't care. We're going. Just before we start, I'll remind everybody, do buy courses at the Academic Agency. The Trivium, the bestseller there. Foundations of Shakespeare still out. You know, I'm playing this trailer. I still don't like it very much. I want a better trailer, but I still haven't kind of figured out what it should be. So I'm just going to play this one instead. And then I will give you an opportunity to show Mark once we're the other side of the advert.
Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Foundations of Shakespeare. Buy it now. All right. Yeah, anything you'd like to promote, Mark, before we get going here?
Not really. Just the Twitter. You can find me at Not So Obvious on Twitter, posting my own daily slot and all the rest. At the moment, maybe have some stuff in the works. We'll see. But I'm not going to hype stuff up before it's done.
So this stream is called the surprising Democrat response to Trump revealed. We want to know a little secret, Mark. I have a little machine I call the Sloppinator. I come up with a title for what I would call the stream, what any normal human being would call the stream. I run it through the Sloppinator and it throws up stuff like that. So I then go with the sloptastic headline to try to lure people in with the promise of slop and bait. And then I hit them with the anti-slop. So you've got to have some bait. You've got to have some bait, but then bam, I did it earlier on with my David Lammy video. I was kind of,
I really enjoyed that video, by the way. I thought it was great. I love the contempt.
Thanks a lot. I was in a particular, you know, I record all my videos in one day. These days I do like all four of them back to back. I imagine that's how Sticks, Hex and Hammer works, and I'm like trying to do my own version, but I don't do three videos a day. I do four a week, right? And I was in a particularly bad mood when I recorded these videos, and if people are like kind of, I don't know if you get to like know someone well enough that you can kind of detect what sort of mood they're in. But if you see progressively, I get in a worse and worse mood. So by the end of the Thursday video, I'm positively just had enough. I don't know. Can't remember what it was that had narked me that day, but I was just in a not in the best of mood when I recorded this week. But anyway, we have two, like a mini story, and the main kind of item I want to cover is a video by Ezra Klein that was put out last week in the New York Times, where the stirrings of a Democrat comeback are kind of starting to rumble. But before before we get there, I couldn't help but notice that we in this country have a new U.S. ambassador, and I made a little post earlier on where I was kind of joking about this. You know, sorry to ask this, but I need one of you to be the U.S. ambassador, and then you've got the Nazgul there. Honestly, we have to watch this, because you know when you're watching like a kind of Hollywood, you know, like an old Hollywood film where, you know, the villain is a kind of pristine, slightly camp, sinister Englishman, you know, classic kind of Hollywood villain, you know, it's usually played by Alan Rickman or someone like that. Well, this video, it's like if you'd ask somebody to kind of make up a cartoon version of a British villain, this is what the Starmer government has given us. So,
I'm Peter Mandelson, and I'm proud to serve as His Majesty's British ambassador.
I mean, is that a face that says "Trust me, Mark"?
You know, he reminds me of is it Charles Dance in Ali G, who's the corrupt MP who's always who's trying to oust the PM?
I mean, you could have said Charles Dance in Game of Thrones, but I suppose that's
that would be
a bit quick ass for Mandelson, you know.
It would be a bit too, yeah, exactly. It's too much like a compliment that way, as opposed to anything else.
Of course, Game of Thrones fans, Tywin Lannister was the boss of that show. You know, all of the base people were secretly on Team Tywin. Anyway, let's carry on.
To the United States of America. It's great to be up and running in the US, a country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admire so much. I'm speaking to you...
So slimy!
It becomes so much better if you just imagine, like, the sarcasm in every sentence. As if he's saying it.
I have to say, the way he says admire is so ridiculously slimy. I was watching this again, watch.
It's great to be up and running in the US, a country in which I have spent so much of my adult life and admire so much. I'm speaking to you from the ambassador's residence. The building that symbolizes decades of friendship, hosting countless presidents, prime ministers, politicians, royalty, and many ordinary American citizens. I'm crystal clear.
David Lammy.
The UK has no closer ally than America, and no one does more than our two countries together in intelligence sharing and defense.
Some people are asking, who is this? Well, you know how I call Tony Blair the Dark Lord? Back when Blair was the Prime Minister, Peter Mandelson was one of Blair's right-hand men, and he was dubbed by the UK press as the Prince of Darkness. He was Tony Blair's spin doctor, his personal director of communications, almost the Goebbels to Blair's Hitler, if you want to put it that way. And Starmer, in his infinite wisdom, has decided that this is the man to bridge the gap between the Labour government and the Trump administration.
Doesn't he famously as well been hypercritical of the US as well, like quite famously?
Well, he's been critical of Trump.
Yeah,
the thing is, the difficulty is that a lot of people, especially regime creatures like Mandelson, have is that the regime believed that Trump would be gone. Like the script was for him for the 2020 election, J6 and all of that, to do Trump in. And of course, it didn't do Trump in. So all of these people were speaking as if, you know, they were.
Yeah, we would never see him again.
he was a vanquished foe, right? And that's the issue that a lot of them have. Quite how Mandy is going to be the one to heal this rift, I don't know.
Well, he's done two things to strike me about this. One is Trump has cancelled all the DEI contracts and Mandelson is gay. So maybe it's like a slight from Starmer to Trump. The DEI hire is the ambassador to to the US. Secondly, he has actually come out and said the UK must respect Trump's mandate. You know, he's going hard on the pro-Trump mandate thing. Any disagreements must be directly and privately handled rather than public. So he's already like calling the spin for, you know, Labour politicians. He's basically acting as like a second whip, right?
To your typical American kind of member of the public who doesn't remember Mandelson or doesn't know who Peter Mandelson is, this must come across like Kevin Spacey from from House of Cards, right? I mean, they must just watch this and think, yeah, we've seen this character before. It's Kevin Spacey from House of Cards. You can't, like, how are we going to trust this snake, you know? But anyway, let's carry on.
Our jet fighters, our naval missions and army special forces operating together in the world, our deep economic and cultural ties are unrivaled. Looking ahead, President Trump's administration is shaping up to be one of...
I mean, have they put like a glow? Have they got like a filter on the lens where it's glowing a little bit with that music underneath? This is so fucking sinister. I can't believe it. I can't believe this is real. I really can't. Jonathan Pryce in Tomorrow Never Knows. He is so classically villainous. I kind of love it, to be honest, but...
The most consequential periods in modern America. I feel energized by the opportunities opening up to work more closely together in tackling threats to our security and collaborating together in exploiting new technologies to boost jobs and higher living standards. I was born in London to a middle-class family. My father was from Jewish parents.
Oh, well, that's a tick in the Trump column. Trump will love that bit.
Whose own father helped found a local synagogue.
I mean, this is really the angle, isn't it? This would be the angle.
Yeah.
Of course, that's the angle.
My loving mother was always there for my older brother and me, and my father worked hard to send us both to university. At Oxford University, my passion for learning and to drive change was ignited. I've served as a legislator, elected first to the House of Commons, and more recently in Parliament's upper house. I've also helped found and grow a successful international business, promoting market access and investment.
Is it just me, or does this feel like it comes from a different world? Like, what fucking planet? The British Foreign Office, right, under the auspices of Lemmy and under Starmer, they thought long and hard, how are we going to mend this relationship? And this production is what they've come up with. I'd love to see a cold reaction of like your typical MAGA voter watching this. I just don't understand like what they think is going to, or Trump watching this. He's just going to be like, anyway, let's carry on.
Around the world, I'm ready to bring my policy knowledge, entrepreneurial spirit, and experience at the highest levels of government to this role. As Northern Ireland Secretary, I was responsible for implementing the Good Friday Agreement, which finally brought peace to that troubled part of the United Kingdom. Today, the UK government's number one priority...
Mark, am I hallucinating? This really feels like, you know, like in a movie where they cut to, it feels like something from a film. It doesn't feel like it's real.
It feels to me like this is the promo video that they put on a big screen outside the residence and it plays on a loop 24/7 sort of to mollify the masses, basically. I'm here. I'm doing a job. I'm good at the job. Don't question me. Carry on. GDP line go up. Good.
Is economic growth. More than 1 million Britons work for US companies and 1 million Americans work for UK firms. The UK and the US already have $1.5 trillion invested in each other. And I'm confident we can go even further and faster together. I'm hugely grateful for the warm welcome since our arrival. Ronaldo, with whom I have lived happily for 28 years, and I are so happy to be here making our home in the great United States of America. We look forward to exploring this magnificent country from coast to coast, from state to state, and meeting many new friends along the way.
Jesus Christ, I just can't.
He's on holiday at the end.
I just can't believe that advert. It's just not even an advert. That is the opening gambit in the diplomacy attack from the British government. It was like something out of a Bond film. It was like something out of a Bond film. It was like
after this speech, like the camera pans down on like a dystopian vista or something.
It's just so fucking weird. Anyway. So I had to share that as a kind of little amuse-bouche before we get into the main course here, which is, I mean, I don't know how you feel about Trump, Mark. I am doing my best to remain level-headed and realist at all times. There's been a lot of enthusiasm from our friends across the pond. I've been more critical. I happen to think people are getting a bit too carried away. It's only been a month. Oh, America's saved. He's only, fired off a pile of executive orders, and lo and behold, the country's saved. You know, forget about all the other problems. We're so back, baby. And it's got to the point where, I mean, I honestly think that the range of people kind of worth paying any attention to has really shrunk, because I just look across the timeline, and I mean, it's like, well, look, I could just subscribe to Alex Jones, because basically all anybody's giving me is Alex Jones right now, right? I mean, there's or Dr. Steve Turley or someone like that. Now, okay, fair enough that those guys have those brands, but everybody's flicked into that mode. And it strikes me that when people are in that mental headspace, that is when the system can kick into gear and really triply fuck you, basically, or is when people can be the most easily manipulated, is in a moment like this where people are kind of letting their emotions run the show. So I've just, you know, been doing my best to present, you know, to be like, okay, well, this looks good, this looks good, this looks good. I'm not sure about this, I'm not sure about this, I'm not sure about this. I'm trying to get away from the whole white pill, black pill dynamic that has gone on. But yeah. Just as another neutral observer, what are your thoughts of early Trump before we get into this?
So I look at Trump, and I paid a lot of attention, especially to his initial speeches and those initial actions that he took. I'm curious again about the reaction. I actually think this video we're going to go over is going to be quite interesting, in terms of the vibe, but also in terms of direct actions. For me, it's also looking at it in an international context and what Trump's aspirations are. And if he's frustrated at home, sort of what are the decisions that will be made regarding sort of foreign relations and stuff like that. So a lot of people are really excited, and understandably so. Like, he made that statement that we're going to stop taxing our own people, we're going to tax foreigners more and stuff like that, right? And they will pay for America. Now, obviously, as someone who doesn't live in America, this is just like interesting in terms of positioning, from my point of view, where I want to figure out, like, you know, how is the UK, you know, it's selfish or whatever, but how is the UK going to fare when the US does all these different things? What's our relationship going to be like to the EU and stuff like that? How is Trump going to react to get wins? Because I feel like he can get wins more for himself specifically, can get wins by targeting extra, the international bodies. more than he can do at home with his current House and Senate margins and stuff like that. So it's like if his policy stuff starts getting stymied by the machine at home, how does he then, you know, he could grab wins at the expense of other countries. The Greenland thing is also like a weird thing for me where I'm like, I'm curious how that's going to pan out. But yeah, in general, I'm neutral on Trump, basically, because I don't think that there's a lot of people crowing everything that happens in America then immediately follows suit in the UK. And I'm like, well, this UK government, if they want to stick around, is going to outlast Trump anyway. So there could be a sort of neutrality slash indifference to what's going on in the US, mm-hmm. as they know that they'll just be around longer than them.
Interesting, Mark, because I think we're getting Nige, whether we like it or not. I think we're getting Nige. But anyway,
I think we'll get Nige as well, but we'll get Nige after Trump, a year after Trump has ended.
So. Yeah, well, that's a good point, actually. I do have a video coming out tomorrow where I talk about, or maybe it's the Thursday video. It's one of the other videos I've got coming out this week. It's basically talking about how to deal with, you know, Greenland, talking about Canada being the 51st state, the Gaza story, which has been big this week. And basically just saying, like, look, with Trump, you have to just wait and see what happens, because he's always been like this, bellicose and over the top. And he's got this negotiation strategy where he sets out a really outlandish position, but what actually happens ends up being a lot more moderate. So it's basically me going over the rules of the 5-day rule. Trouble is, Mark, 5 days have passed since a lot of those stories first broke. And yesterday you just came out and said them all again. And I don't know what to do about that, because 5 days have passed and now he's like doubled down on all the stuff, like the Canada 51st state. And I came out again and talked about Gaza being it's going to be beautiful, it's going to be like the Riviera, we're going to put hotels down there, oh, it's going to be lovely. Oh, what about the Palestinians though, can they go back? Oh no, they're going to have to, they'll be safe, but we're going to put them somewhere else. And I'm like, okay,
he basically wants to manufacture like his own little Monaco in between Israel and Palestine. And
I mean, the trouble is, like, okay, you can talk about it like a real estate 1980s tycoon or whatever, which is, you know, like, he's so blasé and nonchalant. But the whole issue is that those people believe that Gaza is their homeland, right? It's not like it's not about like them being safe, or it's like the whole point, the whole thing is about them wanting to fight for their homeland. And he's just like, just talking about it like a real estate deal.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't really, I still don't, I'm still holding to my 5-day rule, but I will read something that somebody wrote. I won't say who it was, right? But these are the kind of things I've seen in various chat groups and so on, where basically they're saying that if he goes through with the Gaza thing, it's going to dominate and define his presidency. And that it'll be a lasting calamity for the right, basically. And then, a whole list of things. It's imperialistic, against everything that MAGA was supposed to be. It's ethnic cleansing, which will be associated with populism more broadly. It'll open the gates to charter cities and kind of mold buggy and theocracy, hand Israel and Zion all their dreams. It will leech all the energy from Trump's presidency. It will inflame wider conflict involving American troops. It's going to embolden BRICS and spark an economic meltdown. I mean, those are the sorts of thoughts that are going around in some circles. I'm kind of the opinion that all of that might happen and it still won't matter a jot to his base, because I believe that they are basically a function of him. Right. Yeah. I think that he could announce tomorrow that he's invading Mars and they'd still cheer it on. And I'm talking like everybody, like, I just don't think there's any distance at all between Alex Jones and the most quote-unquote intelligent commentators. They're all basically just either fully paid up shills or just so on board the train that it doesn't really matter at all. So, I mean, that's kind of my view. I've also been reading a lot of Victorian kind of imperial era works. I've been reading Halford Mackinder and like various other writers from that time. And one of the interesting things is that even during like the peak of the British Empire, foreign policy issues, you have a look and, you know, British Empire is involved in all of these really complex entanglements abroad. And like people at home are talking about like, oh, what time is the pub shut? And it's like, what dominated politics that year? Was it the crisis in Egypt? Oh, no, it was people talking about like pub closing times or, you know, there's too much rubbish on the streets or something. And it seems to me that domestic issues always trump foreign policy in terms of how it plays at home.
You know what I mean? Say that. I understand what you mean, but we live in the information age where people are paying attention to international issues far more because that's what's shoved in their face, right? You know, like all of the little tiny local news and newspapers and the people that you would talk to in order to actually get stuff done at home, like none of that exists anymore. And everyone is just getting their news about whatever corner of the world's blowing up today online or through the BBC or whatever. So it feels like a different landscape in terms of the information war, because if they want to push a foreign thing and that's all anyone will talk about, to, you know, ignore the rubbish on the streets, that'll dominate. It feels that way to me.
But the thing is, though, is that, yes, you're right, but all of those issues aren't real because they're just on a screen. So they're still virtual. Yeah. They're hyper real. And they don't actually affect you in any way. Right. So we can sit here and talk about Palestine and Gaza, but it's still ephemeral. It's still not real for us.
Yeah.
Right. What is real is, oh, has the council been to take your bins out or the potholes in the road, as I talked about before. And when push comes to shove, those are the things that actually move people to vote one way or the other. I mean, look at the election, right? Everybody talked about how Starmer's stance on Gaza may cost him. Okay, well, I mean, they won a couple of seats, but Labour still won, right? They still won a stonking majority, right? So it didn't actually, like, when push comes to shove, it didn't actually matter as much as everybody wanted it to, or as much as people think it does. And again, this is just value-free. My views on the issue are completely irrelevant. I just feel
what you're saying there seems sensible, but at the same time, I look at the last election as the disillusionment election, with a poor turnout and everybody abandoning the Tories and everyone deciding that nothing could be done and it was just going to be Labour. You know, I didn't see the enthusiasm for local issues propelling Labour to a platform in the way that you're describing. I think that might be a false equivalence there.
Well, I mean, the immigration is a domestic issue too, don't forget. And that's why the Tories lost, you know. So anyway, with all of this preamble, is coming in to discuss the executive orders and whether they're going to be effective or not. I've noticed that they are all being challenged in court, with the exception of one very, very particular executive order, which, as far as I can see, has not been challenged yet. And that was the order on anti-Semitism. I don't think any judge has struck that one down yet. But all of the others are currently being challenged, and that's an ongoing live issue. Now, what's interesting to me is the way that... So, again, this is why I keep on telling people not to focus on what I call slop, right? slop is, oh, look at the libtiers. Look at this idiot wokester on CNN. Look at this this black woman talking or you know, talking her rubbish. And if you go on Twitter, that's all anybody pays attention to. But what are people actually like? What is Ezra Klein saying in the New York Times? And how are the Democrats actually thinking about this? Because it's obvious to me that all of the leftist intelligentsia left woke behind about a year and a half, 2 years ago, right? If you watch Young Turks or Aram Bastani or any of these people, they are focused on something completely different. So let me just play this video from Ezra Klein. Mark, we'll do it in the time-honored fashion. If you've got something to say, say pause, and we'll pause it, okay?
Sure.
Understand the first few weeks of the second Trump administration. Go back and listen to what Steve Bannon told PBS's Frontline in 2019.
The opposition party is the media. And the media can only, because they're dumb and they're lazy, they can only focus on one thing at a time. All we have to do is flood the zone. Every day we hit them with three things. They'll bite on one and we'll get all of our stuff done. Bang, bang, bang.
I will mention, by the way, that Steve Edgington, who I think watches this show occasionally, or certainly watches me, interviewed Steve Bannon recently. And that was a really good interview. And Bannon is one of the guys in the Trump orbit that excites me more than anyone else. Right? The game he talks is way better. Like, I can get more excited about that than the things that make Ben Shapiro excited or the things that make Elon Musk excited, right? And what I particularly like about that interview that Bannon gave with Edgington is the dripping contempt he's got for the tech bros, right? I mean, if anybody's fighting for actual quote-unquote MAGA or the people or whatever, it's Bannon. You know, not saying he's perfect or he doesn't have view, you know, I agree with every single one of his views. I'm just saying that he seems more like the real deal than so many of the other people. And if you listen to the way he's talking at the moment, he seems like he means business. What I really liked is that he plays tough with likes of Elon Musk. He's not like all out gushing. He's like, no, I'm the real MAGA. You need to earn my trust, right? Not kind of dropping his knickers at the first person who shows him any bit of attention. So that is one worth watching if you haven't seen it. I thought it was a really good interview, but anyway, let's carry on.
These guys will never be able to recover, but we got to start with muzzle velocity. So it's got to start, it's got to hammer, it's got muzzle velocity.
Muzzle velocity. Bannon's insight there is real. Focus is a fundamental substance of democracy. It is particularly the substance of opposition. People largely learn of what the government is doing through the media. So if you overwhelm the media...
A record-setting number of executive orders.
Everybody pardoned. Violence, nonviolence.
Including assaulting police officers.
Birthright citizenship.
We live in unprecedented times right now.
If you keep it moving from one thing to the next...
So far, so good.
Is this legal?
If you give it too many places it needs to look...
You've never been deported before?
You have to fill.
All at once.
All federal grants and loans will be halted.
Look, there is a purge happening.
Frankly, unprecedented in its nature.
Guantanamo. DEI.
The Gulf of America.
No coherent opposition can really emerge. It is hard to even think coherently. Donald Trump's first 2 weeks in the White House have followed Bannon's strategy like a script. The flood is a point. The overwhelm is a point. The message wasn't in any one executive order or announcement. It was in the cumulative effect of all of them. The sense that this is Trump's country now. It is his government now. It follows his will. It does what he wants. That he is limitless. If he says that birthright citizenship is over, then it's over. Or so he wants you to think. In Trump's first term, people said, don't normalize him. In a second, though, the task, I think, is a little bit clearer. Don't believe him. Because Trump knows the power of marketing, the power of belief. If you make people believe something is true, you make it likelier that it becomes true. He clawed his way back to great wealth by playing a fearsome billionaire on TV. He remade himself as a winner after the 2020 election by refusing to admit he had ever lost. The American presidency is a limited office, but Trump has never wanted to be president. What he's always wanted to be is king. And his plan this time is to first play king on TV. If we believe he is already king, if we believe he already has all that power, we will be likelier to let him govern as a king. We will then give him that power. Don't believe him.
Now, a lot of people may be thinking, like, all this is like Democrat bullshit. But if you look at it from the flip side of what a lot of MAGA cheerleaders are saying, this is the Curtis Yarvin Moldbug playbook that Ezra Klein is describing, that Trump wants to govern through the executive, that he does want to be more monarchical, executive power. This is all the stuff that, this is where all the elite theory goes, right? This is just the Democrats kind of, or Ezra Klein at least, recognizing some aspect of this. Okay, so this is not BS. Okay, some of the stuff he's saying is, stuff that we don't care about. What I'm saying is the fundamental analysis is basically right. Trump is actually trying to do this. And this is why I think this video is worth watching, because it means that the left are not a bunch of clueless woke morons, which is the prevailing narrative. They're actually these people, and they're actually paying attention to what's happening, and they know what's happening. So let's carry on.
Trump has real powers, but they are the powers of the presidency, the powers Joe Biden had, the powers Barack Obama had. The pardon power is vast and unrestricted, and so he could indeed pardon the January 6th rioters. Federal security protection is under the discretion of the executive branch. And so, yes, Trump could remove protection from Anthony Fauci and Mike Pompeo and John Bolton and Mark Milley and even Brian Hook, this largely unknown former State Department official who's under threat from Iran, who even donated time to Trump's transition team.
I would be very happy to put President Trump's record in the Middle East against any other president.
All of this, it was an act of astonishing cruelty and callousness. This from a man who nearly died by an assassin's bullet months ago. As much as anything ever has been, this to me, this was an x-ray of the smallness of Trump's soul. But it was an act that was within his official power. But the president cannot rewrite the Constitution. Within days, his birthright citizenship order was frozen by a judge, by a Reagan appointee, who told Trump's lawyers, "I have difficulty understanding how a member of the bar would state unequivocally that this is a constitutional order. It just boggles my mind."
I love how the left are all about the Constitution now, by the way. They fucking love the cons. They are all legal experts straight away. They love the New York Times and the Democrats are in love with the US Constitution at this moment. But anyway, Mark, anything you want to mention here so far? Any thoughts?
The thing that's jumping out to me is, like, as a strategy, I'm trying to evaluate whether or not there's the flood thing, right? Or whether or not, because we presume that Trump has learned from his first presidency that trying to do things, as this video will go on to say about doing it the slow way, that if you do it, if you do these things slowly, you run into the issue that everything gets locked up anyway and that nothing gets done. So to my mind, the flood strategy is not necessarily just about sowing disarray into the opposition, but also about identifying who are going to be the standard bearers who oppose particular points of legislation. It's harder to understand in the deluge of executive orders which ones Trump considers to be paramount, like the ones that he wouldn't back down on, the ones that he's absolutely, they're going to go ahead no matter what, regardless during his presidency, or that he's going to push the hardest. But there's a value to that kind of confusion if you can get your opposition to basically expend energy into executive orders that after 2 years in court or whatever, you're just going to say, okay, you can have that one because I got the other one done that I wanted. But what I'm looking for is that it feels to me like he's trying to identify those people who are the most threat to his particular orders in this, rather than exercising kingly authority or whatever. I feel like there's a more strategic play in the works.
Well, I mean, a super cynical take that some people may have is that the real reason for Trump doing this is just to get everybody, just to get his own base on board. So they think that he means business, right? Whereas, so the real people being distracted are actually the Republican base themselves. Right. That it is just kind of like, you know, the Tories do the red meat thing. It's just like red meat on steroids, where nothing's actually going to change. That would be a super cynical take. Whereas in all of the noise, right, there are some things that do get through. Like that anti-Semitism bill, for example. That's not being struck down. So that one's going to stay. Yeah. All the red meat, that's going to go. So what? And all of the other sinister shit that the tech bros want to do, you know, like putting in the Larry Ellison plan or whatever, that will stick, you know. But some of the other stuff is not going to stick. It's just kind of, you know. So there is there's a cynical way of looking at it as well. Time will tell as to which version is true, and I think this is the truth. Is that at the moment, nobody quite knows. Nobody, I don't think anybody knows, right? Apart from Trump himself, I suppose. Maybe even Trump himself doesn't know what the hell's going on.
Again, I liken it to Tony Blair in 97, who is a slightly different situation. But he used basically discretionary powers to circumvent the Houses of Parliament in a number of ways. And it seems like the US is more robust, basically. The system is more robust against that. Because I can't remember how many laws it was Tony Blair passed, but it was something insane, like one every 4 hours or something like that.
Yeah, and hundreds of tens of thousands of
laws. Yeah. And so looking at it, it's like Trump seems to be trying basically that at the moment. And then everything's currently being challenged. But we won't know until the results of those challenges come in, because I expect the Democrats to challenge basically every decision that he makes anyway, baseless or not, because it slows him down.
I think it's worth looking at the difference between what Trump is doing and what Blair did, though, right?
Yeah.
What Blair did is that, he did do the one law every 10 minutes or whatever thing he did, okay, but what he actually built was lasting institutions, right?
Yeah.
He established things that he could stuff with his cronies, right? He established extra governmental bodies stuffed with Blairites that are still there now, even though he hasn't been in power since 2007. It means that he's basically the permanent leader of the country, because you know, whether it's the Supreme Court or Ofcom or any of these other quote unquote independent bodies that review things, it's the Blairite Reich, right? I'm not sure if Trump is doing that, though. None of his executive orders seem designed to have like a lasting, like to last, right? Yes, he set up the Doge thing, right? The Doge thing with Elon Musk. And the way he did that is actually kind of interesting, because he used existing legislation that Obama set up that was actually voted on by Congress and simply retooled it, right? Which is very clever. So that can't just be removed by executive order, right? Everybody thinks that Elon Musk came into being through EO, but he didn't. The EO, if you read it, just changed the name. That is the only thing where he's done like a truly Blairite type move, i.e. oh, this is a Trumpist institution now, right? The one that Musk is in charge of. Other than that, what he's trying to do is flood the zone, right? It's creating a lot of noise. And then he's literally just trying to put his guys into it. Like, he's trying to take over the rival castles, if you want to put it in those terms. Trouble is, if you have a look at the personnel, he's doing it with people like Marco Rubio. So the cell is like, well, these are kind of GOP people. Oh, they're based now, right? You have to just like, and this is basically where I don't believe the people who are very, very hyper white pilled on Trump or whatever. I just don't believe these people who've been around Washington for years are suddenly just like all in on this, you know, revolutionary Bannonite movement, right? I don't see it at all. But anyway, time will tell. Time will tell. Let's carry on.
Then a judge froze Trump's spending freeze. He froze it even before it went into full effect. And shortly thereafter, the Trump administration rescinded the entire order, in part to avoid a court case that it seemed pretty clear they would lose. What Bannon wanted, what the Trump administration wants, is to keep everything moving fast.
Muzzle velocity. Uh-huh.
If you're always consumed by the next outrage, you can't look closely at the last one. Then the impression of Trump's power remains, and the fact that he keeps stepping on rakes is missed. The projection of strength obscures the reality of weakness. Don't believe him. You can see this.
See, my issue, Mark, is that I essentially think this is correct, this analysis from Ezra Klein. I just think he's right. I think that is what Trump does. Just keep it moving. Keep it moving. Don't focus on the last thing. And see, this is where I stepped off. And like, any time I've got anywhere close to quote unquote Trump train, right, you end up getting burnt. Right, you end up getting burnt by it. I remember, and all you need is a memory, right? I remember there was a whole news cycle during Trump 1.0, released the Pfizer memo. Do you remember that? The Pfizer FISA memo. Yeah. And I remember I made a video. It got tens of thousands of views, and I watched an Alex Jones where he was talking about the Pfizer memo, and then I, you know, putting some of my world class research skills together, I was like, hold on a second, that document that Alex Jones shared and said that it was the smoking gun was an old document from a couple of years back. It was fucking fake, right? And this is the thing with the David Lammy reheat, right? It was just fucking fake. And I was like, I've never forgotten that. I was like, right. So I, you know, in good conscience and, you know, thought I was doing, and then I looked into it and I was like, oh, the story is fucking not real. And there's been too many occasions where you get burnt like that. You just get burnt over and over again. And my conclusion is that what Klein is saying here is that there's a lot of smoke and mirrors. It's a lot of noise without a lot of substance, because it's just keep it moving, keep the energy going, keep the energy going. And then by the time you've kind of, everybody's already moved on to the next thing. So nobody cares about that Pfizer memo anymore, right? Because it's a dead story already, because the news cycle's moved on. And this is it. Like, the whole thing about slop is that the slop is basically generated by Trump, right? I mean, and there's it's like a strategy. It's like a, and I just don't know whether it's going to get at people the change they want in the long run, because my suspicion, Mark, is that it's basically designed to for his own benefit, for his own position. It's not America first. It's basically Trump first is my suspicion, but I could be wrong on that.
Well, you know, I basically agree with you anyway on this particular point. To kind of steel man it a little bit, I would say, because obviously you look at stuff from, again, Trump 1.0 that didn't go, I feel like the capacity for him to do things is not, it is higher this time around. But I think what we've been dancing around is whether or not anything that he does will have a lasting impact because it uses the same mentality as, say, a Blair, where you're looking to establish things that are there beyond yourself. So whilst the slot news cycle is like 2 days or whatever, 2 weeks, if Figure keeps pushing it, like, you know, Elon Musk going off from the H1B thing into the grooming gangs or whatever, you know, they can keep a news cycle going a little bit longer. But the reality is that you need to be thinking not just about the next 4 years, but establishing stuff. The clip from that interview with Tony Blair, or what's the role of a former prime minister? Evil laugh, yeah, exactly. Capital in. You know, as you say, it's the forward thinking that I don't see necessarily from Trump. One of the most black-pilling moments for me was when he launched that meme coin. Trump Melania meme coin bullshit. That's such a self-serving decision to be made that doesn't benefit anyone, and in fact doesn't that actually cause, I imagine, a good chunk of his base will lose money on that.
Fleece the marks, right? Just fleece the marks. He's thinking more like a pro wrestling promoter or something. Fleece the marks at this moment. On the longevity question or the legacy issue, it was interesting because he was asked the other day, Trump, is JD Vance going to be your successor? Right. Now, Trump has not named an heir. If he's the king, he hasn't named an heir, right? Yeah. And Trump just came flat out said no. No. Oh, Vance has got great qualities and so on, but he's not, like, he just killed it dead. So it's like, if you're JD Vance, you're sitting there thinking, fuck, I'm the vice president and I'm not the successor. Right? And it's like, he didn't need to do that, right? He's basically, you know, that Trump's word carries so far. He's basically just killed Vance as the possible next president, right? He's probably right in that assessment, to be honest, because Vance doesn't have it, does he? He doesn't have the X factor. But it also means, like, if you want a Trumpism beyond Trump, what's it going to be? Right? Because Vance was meant to be it. Vance was meant to be, you know, the internet. It's like Vance has kind of memorized all the internet memes and voices them back, and this makes everybody excited, and, you know, he follows some of our friends or whatever. But Trump just, like, said, no, it's not going to be, he's not the guy. Okay, but who is? Anyway, let's carry on.
A few ways. Is Trump playing a part? Is he making a bet, or is he triggering a crisis? Those, I think, are the options. And I'm not certain that even he knows the answer. Trump has always been an improviser. But if you take it as a bet, a calculation, then here is a bet he's making. Maybe this Supreme Court, stocked with his appointees, gives him powers no peacetime president has ever possessed. Perhaps all this becomes legal now that he has asserted its legality. It's not impossible to imagine that bet paying off for him. So what if the bet fails? What if Trump's arrogations of power are soundly rejected by the courts? Then comes a question of constitutional crisis. Does he just ignore the court's ruling? To do that would be to attempt a kind of coup. I wonder if they have a stomach for that. The withdrawal of the OMB order to me suggests they don't, because bravado aside, Trump's political capital is thin. Gallup is Trump's approval rating at 47%. That is about 10 points beneath Joe Biden in January of 2021. Both in his first and his second terms, he entered office with approval ratings below that of any other president in the modern era. And so I thought these defenses of Trump's firings were telling.
It is the belief of this White House and the White House counsel's office that the president was within his executive authority to do that.
The law says he's supposed to give 30 days notice. Yeah. He didn't do that. Do you think he violated the law?
Well, technically, yeah.
Do you believe that it's legal?
By definition, it's his administration. They work for him at the pleasure of the president. And if it's illegal, it should be legal.
So then ask yourself, why isn't Trump trying to make it legal? There is a reason Trump is doing all this through executive orders rather than submitting these same directives as legislation to pass through Congress. A more powerful executive could convince Congress to eliminate the spending he opposes, or to reform the civil service to give him the powers of hiring and firing that he seeks. And there's a good reason to do that. To write these changes into legislation would make them both more durable and would allow him to argue their merits in a more strategic way. He would be reforming the entire system. But Republicans at the moment, they have only a 3-seat edge in the House. Smallest majority since the Great Depression. They have a 50.
Go on, Mark.
So it's an interesting point that he brings up here, but I just want to hark back to my prior point, which was that if you want to move something into law, understanding the arguments you're going to come against in advance is like really strong. So he could submit this and do it the slow way, but that gives his opposition a chance to basically hide the real reason until that it's in court. You know, it could take like 2 years before he could get anything done, basically, in that regard. And then they could blindside him by writing it in initially, at least as an executive order. He then gets the ability to, they have to refute it on the basically the official grounds for refuting it, rather than just you can't do an executive order. They have to present the arguments, which then gives his team basically time to prepare defenses within the legislation that make it less likely it will be shot down, basically. That's my thinking there, rather than doing that. I mean, he's got experience of every piece of legislation he's tried to have done the slow way, basically see so much opposition that it doesn't go through anyway, right? So, yeah.
I mean, it could be that what Trump is doing is actually deliberately tying them up in court for the next 3-4, i.e. keep the enemy distracted in the courts all the time, like they did to him over the past 3-4 years. Keep them in court all the time. I mean, that could be, you know, whether it actually has a result of the order carrying or not is less relevant, that they are having to spend all their time and resources fighting court battles, basically. It would be the idea. Anyway.
Yeah. But,
still seems kind of copey, though, if you ask me.
The 3-seat majority in the Senate. Trump is obviously doing nothing to reach out to Democrats. If Trump tried to pass this agenda as legislation, it would fail. And that would make Trump look weak. And Trump doesn't want to look weak. He remembers John McCain humiliating him in his first term by casting the deciding vote against Obamacare appeal. No. Congress is a place where you can lose. That is a tension at the heart of Trump's whole strategy.
Today, I will sign a series of historic executive orders.
Trump is acting like a king because he is too weak to govern like a president.
With these actions, we will begin the complete restoration of America and the revolution of common sense.
This flurry of activity, it's meant to suggest the existence of a plan. But the closer you look, even at this first 2 weeks, the less true it seems. They are scrambling and flailing already. They are leaking against each other in the press already. We learned that the OMB directive was drafted, reportedly, without the input or oversight of key Trump officials. It didn't go through the proper approval process, an administration official told the Washington Post. For that to be the process and product of such a sweeping signature initiative in the second week of...
Go on, Mark.
So what he's generally attacking here is the concept of the keys, right? Like, he's basically saying Trump isn't paying off his keys to power well enough, essentially. And I don't know how true that is. Like, it's been a month, right? And they're trying to get a lot done. Whether or not basically going above and beyond the keys is an issue in terms of you know, the future trust in his decisions and willingness to go along with what he does. Obviously, in a democracy, it's much more harder than a dictatorship. But I don't necessarily think that's the case.
Basically. The thing I can't get out of my head, though. The thing I can't get out of my head, though, Mark, right, is this. Klein said, the memo was poorly written, blah, 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 blah. I noticed back when Ron DeSantis, I've got an article called Ron DeSantis Containment Lessons and Dangers, something like that, on the Substack. And in that article, I look at the Stop Woke Act that Ron DeSantis passed. Okay, and then I looked at the anti-Semitism bill that Ron DeSantis passed in Florida. Okay,
yeah,
those two bits of legislation are night and day. Okay, the Stop Woke Act is woolly. It's designed so it's got ambiguities in it. If you wanted to have court battles over it, it's easy to see where people would disagree. The anti-Semitism bill, every I, every T, every I dotted, every T crossed, every loophole considered, precise language, you know. And again, you can look at the executive orders and we're kind of in that ballpark. And what that makes me think is some things are for the cameras. The Stop Woke Act was for the cameras, right? Some things are kind of like for the what I call the clown show, and other stuff is fucking serious and they mean it. And
there was a similar vibes to that as well with the in 2020, like when once Biden had got in, there was that whole court case, wasn't there, that ended up going nowhere. There was that some woman was the front of it. It's really annoying me that I can't remember the players involved, where they basically tore it to shreds because it was so poorly written. There were typos and spelling errors and all sorts in it. Because there was a whole load of leaked stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it feels like maybe Trump doesn't have, I mean, he should have, but, you know, when you're looking for people to draft these things, you know, like how strong actually is his legislative support, basically. Because clearly, as you say, this anti-Semitism bill got written correctly. But if he's only got like one competent team and a load of like basically well-meaning midwits with not much government experience, like what, you know,
well, I mean, maybe that everybody tells me it's different. But this is the thing, Mark. Everybody says, oh, Trump 2.0 is different. He means business this time. He's got a team behind him this time. They really know what they're doing this time. My base Stephen Miller and all of this sort of stuff. And it's just like, okay, so how does this happen then? This is the exact same thing as Ron DeSantis. Anyway, let's carry on.
A president's second term? It's embarrassing. But it's not just a spending freeze. The Trump administration is waging an immediate war on the bureaucracy, trying to replace the deep state they believe hampered them in the first term. And a big part of this project seems to have been outsourced to Elon Musk, who's bringing the tactics he used at Twitter to the federal government.
We're about 20% of the original size.
So 80% left?
Yes.
He has longtime aides now at the Office of Personnel Management, and the email that got sent out to nearly all federal employees even reused the subject line of the email he sent out to Twitter employees after the acquisition. A fork in the road. It's a kind of bragging. Elon wants you, he wants everybody to know it was him. The email offered millions of civil servants a backdoor buyout. Agree to resign, and in theory, at least, you can collect your paycheck and benefits until the end of September without doing any work. The Washington Post reported that the email blindsided many in the Trump administration who would normally have consulted on a notice like that. It blindsided many of the people who are going to have to run these agencies that are now going to be dotted by resignations. I suspect Musk thinks of the federal workforce as this huge mass of woke and largely useless ideologues. For most federal workers, they have very little to do with politics. About 16% of them work in healthcare. These are nurses and doctors who work for the Veterans Affairs Department. How many of them does Musk want to lose? How many primary care doctors treating veterans?
Go on, Mark.
That's just such nonsense, you know. Aside from, you know, saying to someone like you can resign if you want to and here's the back pay or whatever, like healthcare professionals in particular tend to have a strong sort of sense of moral duty of care to doing any of these jobs, and then just not going to resign. It's designed to either spread fear amongst those who are the ideologues, who know that they have a nothing job, allow them to get out before they get purged, Well, that's just it, really. Like, it's allowing them to get out before they get purged. Are there some people who are close to retirement who are just going to take it? Probably. But I don't see, like, a massive brain drain from the administration. It's going to be the person, like, you know, whose only job is to search up marriage licenses because you can't print them off at home or whatever, and them being told, like, you know, you're going to be told you're obsolete, justify yourself, like, here's your get out. Like, it just reduces the amount of time wasted.
Yeah, I mean, and let's face it, the reason Musk has the 80% rule, right, is because he's going on Pareto principle, Pareto distribution. Yeah. Musk knows most of the work in every organization is done by about 20% of the people, and about 80% are just like dead word or being carried basically by the productive staff. So he's basically just trying to apply those same principles to the government. Let's face it, lots of this is going to be Democrat wank. I'm just saying that they're still kind of reaching around in the right area here, I think, this Ezra Klein video, much more than any other effort I've seen. Because, you know, the left are kind of lost at the moment. They don't know where they're going. But this particular piece does seem like if they're going to fight back anywhere, it's going to be in this area. Anyway, let's see what else he says here.
Is he hoping to take a buyout? Twitter worked terribly after Musk's takeover. It had these frequent outages and bugs, but its outages are not a national scandal. When VA healthcare degrades, it is a national scandal.
Most of what we're talking about here is a group text.
There is also a serious issue here, right? Which is that if Musk and Trump do this like complete gutting of core federal services and so on, it will actually create a lot of unhappy people or put people on the breadline, or like, this is just a kind of reality of what happens when you have a large patronage network, right? It is actually going to create some suffering, and there could be political blowback from that. So this could just be the Democrats getting in the front door on that, because those people will obviously almost certainly vote against Trump next time if they blame him for ruining their life or whatever, right? So this is
I can also see why Trump and his team are incentivized then to get it done early, basically, so that they can manage the fallout essentially whilst they get things under control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, from a pure politics point of view, it's good to play friend enemy and just actually like, yeah, you inflicted suffering on us, punish your enemies and reward your friends. So I'm actually not against this laying off of federal employees. I think it's like good to crush the rival castle. But it is going to create there is a political cost to it as well, obviously, because
I think it's worth it.
Right. Well, the reason it's a political cost is because it's very possible that normal people will know somebody who's badly affected by it, and they're not going to be thinking about all this sort of stuff. They're just thinking like, oh, people will write about Trump, he harmed my friend or whatever. Like, there will be some people who, you know, that may happen. Not that Trump will care because he's not up for re-election. So it's just go on.
And also the act of rehiring, for instance, all of the people, like, let's say that he goes through, they axe like a huge chunk of the state, and then the Democrats get in because everyone hates Trump, because everyone knows someone who is personally affected. It's like, it would take multiple terms to recreate the level of bureaucracy, basically. So I don't see it as that much cost.
Service at scale, how many people are really needed for that, you know?
What Trump wants you to see in all this activity is command. What is really in all this activity is chaos. They have convinced themselves that speed and force is a strategy unto itself, that it is in a sense a replacement for an actual strategy, for thinking and talking things through, for consultation, for planning things out. Don't believe them. I had a conversation a couple months ago with someone who knows how the federal government works about as well as anyone alive. And I asked him what would worry him most if he saw Trump doing it. And what he said was that he would worry most if Trump went slowly. If he began his term by doing things that made him more popular that made his opposition weaker and more confused. If he worked by stealth, if he tried to build strength for the midterms while slowly expanding his powers and chipping away at the state in the places where it was weakest.
Go on, Mark.
Basically, what you were saying about Labour, like coming in and being, once the Tories are gone, if they were stealthy, if they just got on and fixed the roads and they passed like all the nasty shit that they wanted to in the background that no one was really paying attention to, but if they actually just made people's lives better, that would be scary. That would be the scary thing. It's like, that's what I'm reading here, that you say, basically.
I don't know, though, because I'm just going to fast forward 10 years, right? 10 years. Trump sure. has to build a lasting legacy, right? So there's some... I just worry about all of the stuff Trump doing ending up as so much coffee froth, you know, just froth,
yeah,
just slop, right? So this is why I'm forcing everybody to watch this video, is just to tell everybody to just think, like, okay, but there does need to be something lasting here. Otherwise, right, it will just be, oh, the Democrats come back next time. And we haven't had regime change. There has not been an American Revolution. There has not been a circulation of the elites. It's just back to business as usual. Red hat, blue hat, Republicans versus Democrats forever and ever again. And this is...
Yeah.
This is my overriding thought watching this video, is that they're just cool. They're just fine with this. They're actually not that worried at all. Right. They're not worried. Anyway, let's let him get to the end.
Where people couldn't really see him doing it. But Trump didn't do any of that.
Look, all the people saying 2 weeks, 3 weeks, take a breath are the same fucking people saying America is saved. So don't give me that bollocks. You're the one saying that America is back and America is saved and, oh my God, yeah, blah, 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 okay? I'm the one saying, actually, if there's not a proper plan here, none of that stuff is true, okay? And maybe over time, we'll see. I mean, I want to give him his chance as much as ever anyone else, but it's worth paying attention because these guys are thinking two years down the line already. And all we've got to say is, oh, well, yeah, trust the plan. But we're not going to tell you what the plan is. Right? I mean, what's the plan? Anyway, let's carry on.
Instead,
muzzle velocity. Uh-huh.
And so the opposition to Trump, which seems so listless and absent after the election, now it's beginning to rouse itself. There's a subreddit for federal employees where one of the top posts reads, "This non-buyout really seems to have backfired. I'll be honest, before that..."
It's not a fucking straw man. It's not a straw man. You said it's only been 3 weeks. It's not a straw man that people are running around the place saying America is saved already. And we're so back. And isn't it great that military recruitment is up? And isn't it great that people are getting back into the army? And isn't it great that, you know, I've never been so white-pilled in all my life? But if all of that turns out to be froth and ephemera, none of that stuff is true, is it? And who wins at the end? I mean, maybe this fucker that we're watching, Ezra Klein, ends up with the America that he wants at the end of it. So it's not, I mean, it really isn't. Like, it's not a straw man to say that. That is actually true, isn't it? So this is something worth being aware. Unless you just want to bury your head in the sand and just tell yourself you're winning over and over again. If you tell yourself you win enough, that means you've won. But of course, in the real world, things don't work like that. What do they call it? Magical thinking. It's just magical thinking.
Email went out. I was looking for any way to get out of this fresh hell. But now I'm fired up to make these goons as frustrated as possible. As I write this, it's been upvoted more than 39,000 times. And civil servant after civil servant is echoing the initial sentiment. In Iowa this week, Democrats flipped a state Senate seat in a district that Trump had won easily in 2024. The attempted spending freeze gave Democrats their voice back as they zeroed in on the popular programs Trump had imperiled. Trump isn't building support here, he's losing it. Trump isn't fracturing his opposition, he's finally uniting it. This is the weakness of the strategy that Bannon proposed and that Trump is following. It is a strategy that forces you into overreach. To keep the zone flooded, you have to keep acting. You have to keep moving. You have to keep creating new cycles of outrage or fear to keep the media and the opposition overwhelmed. But then you overwhelm yourself. They are flooding their own zone. I don't know that Trump sees his own fork in the road coming. He may believe he's a power he is claiming. That would be a mistake on his part. It would be a self-deception that could doom his presidency. But the real threat is if he convinces the rest of us to believe he has power he does not have. The first 2 weeks of his presidency have not shown his strength. He is trying to overwhelm you. He is trying to keep you off balance. He is trying to convince you of something that isn't true.
Look, I've got all these clowns in chat, the same fuckers who were telling me the woke could never be put away and now telling me how much America has changed in the past 3 weeks. You fucking clowns. Anyway, let us continue. I thought it was worth taking what Ezra Klein had to say seriously. But this is the thing. Nobody wants to pay attention to what is actually happening. And what is actually happening is that is the left putting their own version of the T-1000 back together, because they have to come up with a proposition that people want to vote for that isn't Kamala Harris, right? And it's going to be, they're going to go back to fundamentals, right? ABC politics. So anyway,
the thing that jumps out at me just quickly is that in the run-up to the election, when we were saying the regime wants Trump, right? The regime wants Trump. Like, look at all these peripheral institutions and how they've adapted their messaging, and especially the media class, but other groups as well. So I'm obviously, again, early days. I'm curious to see how we observe not just what's happening in the government, but how other institutions around the government and beyond align themselves over the course of his presidency. Because I feel like that's going to be much more indicative of the lasting effect of his influence than necessarily whether or not a particular executive order gets shut down.
Very true. We'll see. Very early days, though. We will see. Yeah. All right. So let's hit some of the super thanks here, and then we'll hit the super chats and we'll get out of here. From last week's office hours, this was on the social media discourse matter debate. Jack says, have you ever played BioShock? If not, I think you would get something out of it. It's an atmospheric horror FPS set in an underwater city named Rapture, which is established to create a post-war libertarian utopia. When your character arrives, it is descended into madness. Biohacking has corrupted the city's inhabitants, and Machiavellians are vying to rule over the ashes. Yes, I have played BioShock. In fact, I completed BioShock. It's a good game. It's a good game. Good atmosphere. Kind of creepy as well, with the little dolls and the injections and so on. You ever played BioShock, Mark?
Yeah, played BioShock 1 and 2. Didn't get into Infinite, didn't enjoy that one, but the other two were good.
My main gripe with BioShock, and this will sound kind of petty in a way, but you can't die in that game. BioShock's a game where you literally
easy.
Can't...
It's pretty easy,
You die, and then you just like, oh, I've respawned, like, you know, in the room before I just died. Like, it really is a game where you're just kind of playing to, you know, see new bits of the story, basically.
So you're saying for you it was more of a visual novel than an actual challenge?
It was kind of glorified visual novel, which was kind of aesthetically pleasing, and it had a kind of good sense of location and so on. But as an actual game, you know, I've devised a rating system for games, right? And it was quickly pointed out that I left off writing and storyline as my... I may have to revise that. I completely forgot about writing and storyline, but I've got
emergent stuff anyway.
Well, I've got a category called... I can't remember what that rating system was now. I was going to make a video on my gaming, on my little side gaming channel, where... let me pull up that post a second. Because I've called the system... CC Lulz Drag, right? CC Lulz Drag, where you get 10 categories and you get a rating of 10 out of 10, or out of 10 in each of the 10 categories. And the categories are core mechanics, challenge, loop, user feel, longevity, size, depth, replayability, aesthetics, and grind. Now, BioShock is probably a 10 out of 10 in the aesthetics category, but I'm not sure how, like, I'm not sure if I'd ever play it again. I'm not sure. Like, it's an experience, yeah, isn't it?
It's the case with a lot of these, the story-driven stuff as well, is that, you know, you go through it for the experience and then that's it. You know, the mystery is gone, and so the replayability is not there, in a way. Yeah.
Vasabeton says, your assessment of the EU is strangely similar to what Viktor Orban has been saying for quite some time. The effect of the war on energy security, EU being in the weakest position since its conception, Trump being the wake-up call for the EU, and the need for regime change in Brussels. This was on my video, European Globalist versus American Nationalist, who is going to win? You see, it's remarkable, because when I put that video out, there were genuinely comments saying, oh, you're falling off, AA. You believe too much of the Trump hype. you go through that, and there are people who are like pro-EU, whatever, saying like, "Oh, you know, I've become addicted to it." I mean, what's that quote? You can please some of the people some of the time. You can't. I'm going for the please none of the people none of the time strategy, where everybody's upset with me all the time. But anyway, he says you should look into the career of Orban, the career of Orban, especially what was he had done between 2002 and 2010, how he was able to get from losing the 2006 general election to never losing an election ever since. Yes, that's interesting. You know, I've been reading this book by Halford Mackinder recently, which was written in 1919. It's a terrific book. It's called... what's it called? Democratic Ideals, and what's that book called again? By Mackinder. It's called. I'm just getting up the title of the book. What's it called? That book. It's called Democratic Ideals and Reality. Right, Democratic Ideals and Reality is the book I've been reading, and In that book, he basically predicts Hitler, he predicts World War II, he predicts globalization, coming of a, you know, one world hegemon down the line, various other things. When I say he predicts, he's like, unless you do this, 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 and this, these things are going to happen. And, well, they didn't do this, this, and this, and those things happened. But one of the things he does is he proposes... four nations that are independent buffer zones between Germany and Russia. He says that the conflict between Germany and Russia is the permanent problem for what he calls the world island, okay? And the region in between is what he calls the heartlands. And basically, it's remarkable. In 1919... Mackinder basically invents what is known today as the Visegrad Group. You're aware? Now, who is the Visegrad Group? He doesn't name them as such, right? He doesn't name them as such. But he basically says, look, there are four countries in between Germany and Russia which need to be independent sovereign nations as a matter of imperial strategy. And the ones he names are Czechoslovakia or the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and I guess the Slovak area, right? Now, so he basically outlines the strategy that has actually become a thing in the Visegrad Group, where you have these four nations who are, broadly speaking, not pro-Russian, right? but also not also independent of Germany. Okay. And I think that basically the Americans after World War II implemented a lot of Mackinder's strategies. They didn't listen to him after World War I. The British Empire did not listen to Mackinder in 1919, but the American Empire listened to Mackinder after 1945, and especially after 1991, especially after the dissolution of the USSR. They've basically done his playbook to the T. And the Visegrad Group, Orban, I would see as a function of US, as a frontier nation for the US Empire. Poland the same. Poland the same. I know less about the Czech Republic and the Slovak Republic, but I kind of feel like the US Empire is kind of happy with these more quote-unquote independent powers on its frontier. Hence, Poland gets to be more nationalist. Hungary gets to be more nationalist. Even Turkey, if you see that as a frontier nation, gets to be more nationalist. I kind of find that interesting. Anyway, let's carry on. Run up your thermostat says, this is on the rise and fall of Justin Trudeau video that was made by Black Horse. And it was for $27 Canadian or $28 Canadian. While Trudeau, the hate figure, is gone, nobody should count the Liberals out. Here is why. Number one, Drumpf has united most Canadians, especially older Liberal and even apolitical Canadians, against America. The natural reaction of these people is to go against the Conservatives, who have been framed as being Trump adjacent, and they're being called Maple MAGA. Number two, and I will say anecdotally, the Canadians that I know, all of whom are right wing, by the way, I mean, the 51st state thing has gone down like a lead balloon with them. They are pissed, from what I can tell, the Canadian, including Black Horse and Endeavour and all of the other Canadians we know. They are not up for the 51st state thing at all. And I've also seen a Carney bump. You know, do you remember Mark Carney, Mark, the Bank of England manager?
Yeah.
Well, he has been lined up as Trudeau's replacement. And there's polls being released basically saying that, like, Carney mania is running wild. Now, I tweeted about that and people were like, yeah, do you believe that? These polls are fake type thing. But I kind of believe that Trump's 51st state stuff may have swung things back for the Liberals. Number two,
been saying a lot of stuff saying Canada will stand up to bullies and like their main stuff is like he will win the Liberal. You know, the regime, the Canadian regime wants Carney. That's one thing I'm seeing.
Number two is the Liberals are the default party of a large portion of this country, with a notable exception in 2011 when the NDP was led by a Blair-like figure. And the Liberals were led by a Harvard professor with the charisma of a wet paper bag. The Tories only win when the Liberals are just too hated to go on, which would have been the case had Trudeau stayed. But now Mark Carney is seen as a breath of fresh air for some reason. If the election is held soon, Carney can capitalize on the feeling, which previous bag holder prime ministers like John Turner and Kim Campbell and Rishi Sunak and Gordon Brown, for that matter, failed to do. Number three, quite frankly, the Tories are not offering anything besides scrapping an unpopular policy that Carney is going to scrap anyway. And four, the regime want Carney. He was being looked at as the Trudeau. I mean, if there's anyone who's ever a regime man, it's Mark Carney, right? Ultimate globalist, Mark Carney. He was being looked at as a Trudeau replacement months before Trudeau resigned, despite not even being an MP. The Liberal Party and our media has basically sidelined Chrystia Freeland, many expected a win, and who both parties shower with praise after she dumped Trudeau in Canada, December. Carney is being touted as the saviour of the Liberals, who are putting the Tories on their feet and who will stand up to the evil orange man. In the meantime, he is getting far greater airtime on our major news networks than Poilievre or Freeland. I've got a feeling that analysis could be on the money. I wouldn't be surprised at a Carney bounce. Although a lot of people are saying that it's being astroturf, but if there's one thing the past few years have taught me is that astroturfing works. People are just easily persuaded of various things. And if they localize the evil to just make it personalized to Trudeau, right, and present Carney as a different face, and if Trump has galvanized Canadians against America, well, it's possible, right? It's possible that Carney would win. Not saying he will, I'm just saying that I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. Jimmy C says, this was from the video yesterday, why the US empire will uphold colorblind liberalism. AA, has anyone coined Minge yet as our doji counterpart? If not, have this one on me. What would Minge be then? What would, I can't remember what Doge stands for now. Department of Government Efficiency. And Minge would be the Ministry of Government Efficiency. Oh, yeah. Very good, Jimmy. Very good. Art Dinoism on the same video says, AA, thank you. Do you have any examples of empires that failed to develop an imperial altar? One example that springs to mind, given your own, of the successful Persian Empire, were the Babylonians that took the Israelis captive. Are there any more? And if so, what stopped them? That's a good question. I'd have to look into that. I mean, there's an argument to say that Cyrus the Great didn't really have an imperial altar, that the first Persian Empire was not like Zoroastrian. Zoroastrianism was the official religion of the Sassanid Empire that came later on. Persian Empire, the first Persian Empire, was very pluralistic. It had lots of different religions around at that time. So maybe that one as well. What stopped them? I mean, if you look at it as a political technology, you could just say that they weren't far enough down the tech tree. If you think about it in Civ terms, they hadn't unlocked monotheism yet or something on the Civ tech tree. Next one, European globalists versus American nationalists. Frayne Sustick says, AA and the Chuds are done because I came up with a propositional nation that's going strong for centuries, the Vatican. But joking aside, how does one approach the issue of recently ginned up nations? How to tell when ethnogenesis is complete, or when the people in question could easily be rolled back into what they genuinely are or were for a long time? Obvious problem cases of this sort would be, for example, the Bosniaks, Northern Macedonians, etc. Thoughts? How do you tell when an ethnogenesis is complete? I don't really know the answer to that question. Mark, would you say that there has been an ethnogenesis of the Scots, the English, and the Welsh? Or are they still three distinct people in your view?
It's weird. Like, the downplaying of the English means that the English think there has been an ethnogenesis, but if you speak to any of the Scots or the Welsh, I'd say probably not.
And don't forget,
like the English have this idea that we're all, we like the Scottish, but they much more associate themselves with British. But certainly, like, the entire middle class sees that way. And then, but the Welsh and the Scots, like, they seem to be much more specific. But then there's also the class thing in Britain. So it's like, the higher up the class structure you go, the more likely you are to see us all as one ethnogenic nation. And whereas the working classes tend to lean into and preserve their distinct kind of national cultures, national identity, much more, you know.
I don't know the answer, to be honest, when ethnogenesis actually takes place. Chris O'Hanlon says, aren't certain groups likely to be more expensive, though? This is on the colorblind liberalism. those more likely to commit crime, claim benefits, have low competence on the one hand, or those who contribute very little to the economy through extreme stinginess, loyalties to only their own on the other. Providing £300,000 to build new flats to people on the dole is a thing I have witnessed. Thanks. Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't say colorblind liberalism is good. I didn't say that it doesn't create loads of inefficiencies. But what I said was, as a practical matter, every multi-ethnic empire has to adopt it as a strategy, or some version of it, whether you call it tolerance or, you know, they need something to bind, to keep people grilling and paying taxes into them. And I mean, this is why it's cyclical, right? It's cyclical. It leads directly to the downfall. The very fact that you need the universal doctrine accelerates the end of the empire. That's the literal cycle that they all talk about, that I discuss in Prophets of Doom, whether it's the Roman Empire or the British Empire or any other empire. It always happens. Chris O'Hanlon also says on Debunking Modern Monetary Theory, which is a video that is about 5 years old, are your thoughts still the same on this matter? If anything's changed my thinking on modern monetary theory, it is the book Super Imperialism by Michael Hudson, which basically does mean that as long as America has the biggest army in the world, they have an unlimited credit line, because they can essentially force other countries to buy their debt. So as long as that remains the case, modern monetary theory is true, but only for the American government, until it's not true anymore. Johnny Lister says, whatever happened to King Croc? This is a comment, Mark, on Unpopular Opinions, Season 1, Episode 3, from 2017. Somebody's left a super chat. A channel member. Whatever happened to King Crocoduck? Are you still on good terms with him? No, I'm not on good terms with him. I never actually kind of talked to him or fell out with him in that way. But King Crocoduck, you see, is part of a certain group. And he has become very nationalistic for a certain nation in the Middle East. And he has had lots of debates with Dave Green over this issue, where he maintains, despite all evidence, that that nation in the Middle East is really a liberal democracy, the same as America. Last I saw, he quote tweeted he's blocked me on Twitter, even though I haven't talked to him, and he screenshotted something I said, and kind of was calling me all sorts of names, saying I was dishonest for saying that that country doesn't play by the same rules as everybody else. And he's got all sorts of cope arguments for this, which I'm not interested in, because I'm not interested in engaging with bullshit, basically. So, yes, that's unfortunate. King Crocoduck used to be a man of science, but turns out he is an ideologue of the worst sort. All right, and that's it. And that's it from the super chat. Super thanks. Now the super chats. Breaker says, cynical take, but I don't feel any better about Trump winning. I just noticed that the classic left-right repeat cycle of politics since Reagan, Doge is basically Bush tax cuts 2.0. Yeah, it does feel like it. PS says, I live around a bunch of federal employees who have to go back to the office. I have never seen bureaucrats so afraid. It's like Elon and the Doge team have a sword of Damocles over them. That is good stuff. Well, that's great to hear, PS. I'm happy that at least some sniveling bureaucrats are getting their comeuppance. WYX says, have you seen Devon Stack's most recent insomnia stream? No, I haven't. I was kind of slowly working through it, the one beforehand. These days, I mean, people make such long shows and streams and things. These days, I tend to watch like the first 30 minutes of something, and then like I get busy, and then I start another show and then I never get back to it. Unfortunately, that's how things go. I did see, though, that that show of Devin Stacks is about a pastor that Trump picked, who is kind of mental. Did you see this, Mark? Let me play the video, because I couldn't believe it, really. This was something Devin Stacks shared on Twitter. Just a 49-second cut of Trump's pastor. Let me just share my screen a second. Just unbelievable stuff.
You uncircumcised Philistine.
Hey, hey, ha ha, ho ho, Donald J. Trump, they can't beat my daddy.
Hear the sound of victory.
Hey, hey, Prescott, ho ho, Donald J. Trump.
You're gonna eat your own dung and drink your own urine.
I declare mercy. Saka, saka, saka. Noises, noises, noises. Pika, haka, atta, atta. Noises, noises. Hey, hey, ha ha.
I mean, this is the personal spiritual advisor to President Trump. So
this is bizarre stuff.
Donald Trump, we might be facing the pressure of eating our own dung and drinking our own urine.
Get this!
So I haven't watched that yet, but I might do it on my little drive home in a minute, because I do love a bit of Devon. His last one was pretty good too. I'm still working my way through that one. So he is somebody who's been. I mean, You think I am uncompromising? I am the sensible centrist in this conversation. He is just on a whole different level. Alex Lamont says, AA, what is your opinion of the Kenneth Branagh film adaptation of Henry V? I feel like the cast puts in a good performance generally, and Branagh specifically shines during the speeches. The soundtrack is also good. Thoughts? I'm not the biggest Branagh fan, I'm afraid. I'm really not. So. Yeah. I mean, I would still take the Laurence Olivier one. I take the Hollow Crown one over the Branagh one. I just don't like Kenneth Branagh. Cancel Culture says, I'm curious what your stance on, you know, that thing that triggered the pandemic 4 years ago. Are you, you know, did you take the special, all I'll say is that we're not allowed to talk about it on it on YouTube, and as far as I'm aware, they still come down hard on it. But I did not take it. Did you take it, Mark? Was that a personal question?
No. It's not personal to me. I'm unsullied.
Zero regrets as well. Never regretted anything less in all my life. 22nd Nomad says, the video is good at analysis, but it assumes the courts will stop Trump. The Supreme Court is the same one that instituted Bruin, concealed carry. Well, he did say that it's possible that the Supreme Court, which was handpicked by Trump, would side with him. He did say that. Cringewalker says, Trump's approval hit 54% this week. People clearly like the show. So I think Ezra's call to not believe him will fall on deaf ears. That may be right, Cringewalker. That may be right. I don't know. Maybe right. I have no idea what's going to happen. Broman Hank says, it would be ideal if we had somewhere to retreat from the drivel slop. I made an alt on X to focus on signal, but it seems the deluge is the signal. Well, the thing is that if you make a brand new account on, or if you don't follow anyone on Twitter, the For You section will hammer you with Elon Musk slop. Like, the default is you'll get captive dreamer tweets, even if you don't follow anyone. Don't ask me how I know. VT Vara says, Visegrad 4 are German supply chain, 100% dependent. Okay, that's interesting. Very interesting indeed. But they're created as a buffer zone, right? Because there's no question of Germany attacking Russia, and that they're a buffer between Germany and Russia. And obviously, what the Ukraine war was really about was severing any possibility of the German-Russian alliance actually forming, which is something I would love to see. I mean, Carl was giving me grief on this. He was saying, like, come on, how can you say that? But look, if you look at world history, it's a tragedy that Russia and Germany have never been able to get on. Imagine they teamed up, Mark. Imagine Germany, Russia, and Turkey formed the triple juggernaut. They take the map. Wouldn't you like to see it just once? Just once. Let it happen. Let it happen. But no, there's always somebody.
A lot to talk about. It'd be exciting, wouldn't it?
Right. It would be exciting if something would happen. But no, there's always like, oh, the French don't like it. Or, oh, here are the British to fuck things up again. Or, oh, here are the Americans to fuck things up. Or the Germans and the Russians just cannot get on. You know, if you look at German history again and again and again, it's like, oh, they're fighting a war on two fronts again. Oh, it's the French-Russian alliance. Oh, fuck, fucking doodle-doo. They never align in the right way. And if you look at World War One, or you look at the Second World War, they're always on the opposite end. And it's like, look, if Germany could just side with one side and not have to worry about the other flank, they could do something. Give them a go. Give them a go. They've never had their turn. I mean, I just like to see it from a kind of gamer point of view, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, it's such a there's a masochist in you somewhere, you know.
But the Anglo will never allow it to happen. Bloody. In diplomacy, if Russia and Turkey team up, they take the map, right? But I feel like in the real world, they'd need Germany as well to truly take the map. And I even came up with an idea, because like, well, how do you deal with the Slavs? Because that's a real problem in world history. The Russians and the Germans fighting over who gets to rule over the Slavs. And then the Slavs are like, hold on a second, we don't want Germans ruling us. You know, or we don't want Russians ruling us. So the Slavs are kind of like, despite their name, they don't really like being subservient to other powers, right? I don't know if you've ever met any Poles or anything, but they just don't like it, right? But what you do is you have this triple alliance, the old Ottoman Empire, the Turks, the Russians, and the Germans, and you'd create the Emperor of the Slavs, right? The Slavic Emperor. But he'd be a puppet of the alliance, but you'd present it as if he was an equal partner. So the Slavs are on board because they've got their own ruler there. But really, he's part. So you call it like, I don't know, the four heavenly kings or something. You'd have like four, you know, the unity of the four emperors or something. That alliance, I tell you, they take the map. They really would. Which is why the past 500 years of British foreign policy has been doing anything possible to stop that ever happening. So here we are. Oh, dear, oh, dear. TP says, I wouldn't be surprised if Canada has already been de facto ruled from Washington for at least a century already, and I stand with Denmark and Europe. Sam153 says, great seeing Mark for the first office hours guest. Cheers. Well, thank you very much, Sam153. It means so much. But as a point of order, Pharaoh was a guest last week. In fact, Pharaoh has been a multiple-time guest, and I feel like you've been on here before as well, Mark.
Yes, I have. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't been keeping track of who comes on as a guest, but every once in a while I have a guest on. So there we are. And that's it. That's it for the Super Chats. At least, entropy has stopped. So yeah, I think that is it, though. That is it. Mark, where can people find you, sir?
People can find me on X under the handle Not So Obvious. You can also just search Mark Houghton and you'll find me there.
Yeah, and obviously join the channel, like and subscribe and all the rest of it. Pick up courses at the Academic Agency, Foundations of Shakespeare, buy it now, etc. And I'll be back tomorrow morning with another video. And if you're lucky, there'll also be an Adam Curtis review as well. Although nobody went to Twitter. Right? You know, Adam Curtis review is under threat from the BBC at the moment because they blocked the last two episodes. And so last time, we tried to do this thing where I said, look, everybody at this moment, go over and watch on X. And the miserable bastards in this audience were like, nope, we hate Twitter so much, we're not going. And do you know who I felt like, Mark? I felt like Stefan Molyneux.
No, abandoned.
Everybody's like, oh, if you're so dedicated, I love this show. I'm so dedicated, I'm not prepared to go and watch it on X. So I don't know. I mean, so the only thing I can suggest doing is making them available for download somehow via Substack, right? But I need to find a way of doing that without making them appear on my Substack feed. Does that make any sense? I'm going to upload them to Substack, but I don't want them as part of my main page because there are lots of people who subscribe to my Substack who don't want videos and stuff. So I need to try to make them, like, if I could find a way to get them there without them cluttering up the main page, I'll make them available. But I just had, like, I'm a busy guy, right? So I haven't had time to do that yet. But and then if between the downloads on Substack, the views on the bit that we do on YouTube and on X, if between them all they can get 7,800, Adam Curtis review will continue. For now. We're running this little angle where Simon Roberts, like Stone Cold Steve Austin, fighting against the corporation. You know, remember I did my corporate rebrand? Deepest Lore is like the last vestige of the old AA channel. Still surviving with Roberts flying the flag. And I'm trying to shut it down. And he keeps on somehow surviving. So, all right, everybody. All right. See you tomorrow.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.